and the little man.
Okay.
You know, doesn't it feel like it's summertime, vacation time, you can appreciate your country, white people build America, but wasn't for white people, there would be no America.
Officer Kyle DeFrank asked, is that one of four officers who was attacked by suicide after responding to the Capitol riot? Officer Gunther Shida also took his own life last week. He was assigned to the emergency response team within the Special Operations Division.
You better get back in that ambulance. I'm
talking to the driver. Okay, Mr. Booth, I have a question for you. Did you go to Nautilus for middle school?
Oh, my goodness.
I always wondered what happened to
you, sir. Oh, my goodness.
He's the nicest kid in middle school.
Oh, my goodness.
He was the best kid in middle school. I used to play football with him. And all the kids.
Oh, my
All right, everybody, welcome. We're about to do it again. The first one went so good, we're going to do it again. This is Thursday. That means it's time for everybody to pop off. Whatever it is, here's the ground rules. We want you to call in 646-716-4621. Press 1 on your phone. We'll give you 1 minute to talk about anything. Woo side, get it off your chest. So you're going to get a minute up front, uninterrupted, no criticism afterwards. We let you go at it. If you're hitting some points, we'll go around and ask each of the hosts to award you 15 or 30 seconds to allow you to continue to get it all vented out. But we already got a call up there. But we're going to – this is you guys' show. You know, this is where we all get to come in and just get it off our chest before the weekend and not carry it in. Let's go around. Joe, me and your pop-off is going to be kind of added together. But I'm going to let you do it. I'll play the video and I'll let you do it. But we'll start out, Big John. What's going on? What's your pop-off, bro?
Yes. Once again, welcome, everyone. My pop-off is, and I'm glad Dr. Gorsuch is here tonight, is parents who use their children as weapons. If the mother is mad at the father, she does not allow him to see his children. The father is mad at the mother because she won't allow him to sleep with her still, he won't do shit for his kids. So my pop-off tonight is parents using their children as weapons against each other.
All right, Izzy. Izzy made it here. What's been eating at you all week, man? What do you want to just vent and get out?
My pop-off is... police being so abusive and predatory towards certain groups of people to the point where they are too afraid to even speak out against issues that are targeting them every single day. As a result, makes it difficult to expose and talk about these issues in a real way. Because people nowadays, if they don't have, what do we say, if it bleeds, it leads. If they don't have some nice victim to put up on the page or on the screen, you keep anybody's attention.
All right.
So that's bothering me this week.
All right. Dr. Corsi, what's yours?
Mine is racial hypocrisy. I am tired of selective accountability. That's what my pop-off is about this week. Selective accountability.
Good one. Chief, what's going on? I know you've seen enough to pop off about this week.
Yeah, no, I really don't have any. I guess my pop-off is that Izzy's only got one pop-off.
Not my show. I go all night.
I was just waiting. I got 40 of them. Y'all stand by. No. I'm here along for the ride tonight to jump in on some of this stuff. I got a lot of stuff that bothers me, but it, no, it's like, why is my neighbor? Anyway, I just leave that alone. But anyway, so I'm just here for the ride tonight and chime in. And, you know, I got plenty. I mean, I like Izzy's topic. I certainly like Dr. Crew's topic. Those are two pretty poignant issues there that definitely need to be discussed.
Okay, well, I think
John Stu. I mean, I see that all the time. I see that every stinking week. I see that for child custody exchange, or they're 5 minutes late and they want to do a criminal offense report because the child custody exchange took place here or didn't take place. So, yeah, I mean, I'm just going to go along with everybody else, man. Those are all important issues.
Well, I think Joe and mine is the same. I'm going to visually show mine, and I'll let Joe go ahead and do the rest. Hey, Kimber, how are you over there on the Facebook?
Accusations of racial bias by police after they broke up a fight between a pair of teenagers, one black, one white, at a New Jersey mall. A now viral video shows the teens having a heated discussion. The white teen pointing a finger in the face of the black teen, who pushes the white teen's hand away. The white teen then shoves the black teen, and the two begin to tussle. At one point, the white teen tackling the black teen and pinning him to a couch, then throwing him to the ground. When police arrive to break up the fight, a female officer pulls the white teen away and pushes him to the couch without handcuffs, while the other officer presses the black teen to the ground and kneels on his back. The female officer also comes over to kneel on the teen's upper back while they place him, and only him, in handcuffs.
Oh, no!
Treatment some viewed as unequal, unfair, and racially biased. One bystander exclaiming in surprise as police handcuffed the black teen.
No, it's fucking black.
CNN affiliate WCBS spoke with one of the teens involved, 14-year-old Kai, who asked that his last name not be used.
I was confused, like, well, why they saw me as a bad person, me as a, like, aggressive person.
Later telling CNN affiliate WABC, the fight began after he stood up for a friend, a seventh grader, being picked on by the other teen, who the station identifies as a high school student. The teen calling the encounter with police scary and frustrating.
If they don't know how to treat the situation and deal with the situation equally and fairly, then they shouldn't be able to deal with the situation at all.
New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy saying,
I'm deeply disturbed by what appears to be a racially disparate treatment in the video. We are underscore with emphasis that we're committed to increasing the trust between law enforcement on the one hand and the communities they serve on the other.
Accusations of racial bias.
All right, Joe. I'm gonna let you go because I spent too much time in New Jersey. I'm fully aware of how some, not all, law enforcement operates in New Jersey. But there you go, brother.
It actually, I have to yield to the great Dr. Corsi. She's the one who actually started with this. She sent it to me and we talked about it a little bit. But it actually goes to everything here. The issue here is, upon reading the rest of the reports, it turned out the black kid was actually the victim. I mean, from all the reports, it actually said he was the victim. And I'm reading a couple of books that are kind of disturbing. Kendi X just wrote a book, Stand From the Beginning. It's actually about 2 or 3 years old. But one of the things he talks about is how the system of injustice is based upon learnings that we've had and how it's going to continue to be this way because the same learning is being retaught. And that also applies to all the systems, whether it be the judicial system or the policing system. And everything else, but I would suggest everyone take a look at this Stand From the Beginning. And it's also interesting that quote, Stand From the Beginning, was Jefferson Davis's key line speech in the United States Senate fighting against education for Negroes when he was United States Senator. Stand From the Beginning.
Wow. Let me grab a caller real quick. 203 area code 0263. How are you? What's your pop-off?
Oh, good evening, family. My pop-off is the lack of appreciation for educators all throughout this country who are underpaid and underserved and not properly represented in the field of education, insofar that they are the founding bricks of our society insofar as educating all of us from the ground up, and how they seem to be put, not, I ain't gonna say last, but, and I'm not saying even pay scale so much as just the appreciation of our educators from elementary, middle school, high school, as we're going up to college. I think they are overlooked, underpaid, underserved, and underrepresented. That's my pop
right
off to start.
And I want to throw in another group of people, nurses. You know, I got to throw them in there because they're pretty much getting thrown under the bus too, and they work some hella hours getting us through this pandemic, which we're not all the way done with yet. So got to add them in. But, Joe, that in the incident with the kids in New Jersey, when I saw it, it's sad because it's kids. And I did want to point out, if you watch the video, you know, the white kid totally expected to get handcuffed too. At one point, he even holds his hands out to the female officer who's patting him on the back, like, no, it's okay. So, you know, that kid expected it. You know, maybe it's a generational thing, but he said, okay, it's going to happen to me too. But that's a familiar scene that some of us have experienced, and it's just a part of what we can expect to see. But that one kind of got me fueled when you sent it, Joe, because it's familiar and it's shameful. And that kid is 14 years old, and he got a harsh, clear view of what it's really like out there. Not with every officer, not with every department. So officers, don't get your feelings hurt. And, you know, 646-716-4621, you can call up and anonymously say how you feel about it. But I then heard the comments the mayor had, which is everything we always hear. We're going to we strive to have equality. I was in New Jersey in the 80s stationed there. New Jersey ain't changed all that much. So much for all of it happens in the Jim Crow South, because New Jersey is actually the birthplace of organized racial profiling by police. That's in reference to The Black Dragon, the book that I put on my page that people should actually check out. But Izzy, this dovetails right into what you were leading to in yours. You know, were you aware of that video?
Oh, man, I've been aware of it. I wish... I'm actually, it's why the week's been rough. I've been having like one of those heavy news weeks. I wake up every morning and read about this stuff, and it already is, for me at least. I wasn't surprised by anything of it. In fact, I the first time I saw it, it was like, spoiler alert. I was like, here's what's going to happen. And it didn't really surprise me. And I guess that's one of the things that makes me pop off, so to speak, is that I feel like we keep starting the same conversation over and over and over again, and people being like, why is this happening? Why is this going on? What do you think? Like, we're having a continued debate about why crime is rising. We're having a continued debate about, is there a racial problem in policing and in this country? And we keep restarting the conversation. We don't follow it through. And I don't understand why anybody's surprised anymore. Yes, the black guy's going to get the worst end of the deal with a police response. Yes, our country and policing is racist. Like, yes, all of these things are happening. Now let's move on with the conversation, because it's just going to keep happening if this is as far as we take it and we keep acting like each incident is an isolated incident. Like, why is crime still rising? Do you think it's because we're not talking about housing or health care or mental illness or any of these social services? We're just talking about policing? Could that have something to do with it? I don't know. You know what we should do? Let's wait until this happens again, and then we'll start this conversation all over again. How about that? Cool. See you in a week. Like, it's ridiculous.
Well, and in the meantime, it seems like you're almost waiting for your turn. When will it happen to me? I know it will at some point. You know, you kind of wait on it. And that's the scary part, because some of us in that conversation look at these videos and say, when will it be me? It's not, we don't get to look at it from outside of that zone and say, well, you know, if only the kid complied. That's the excuse you hear all the time. Well, the kid complied, and what did he get? And the thing is, I think, and from my opinion, I think when we view that video, some people look at that incident, and some of us look at the continuation of an incident, in my case, 60 years of possibly these incidents. And so, you know, there is a demographic of people who are concerned about it. I wish, you know, more attention was put into, as you say, following through. You know, firing the officers, it's not solving the problem. Those officers got that from somewhere. They didn't just happen to come together and both react like that. And I don't want to hear training because, like I said, you know, that training, yes, training is always needed, but you always hear that excuse come up. We need more training. No, I think while there's a need for more training, first let's take the training we already have and learn to apply that equally to everyone. Then maybe we wouldn't be in these instances. We have no...
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add implicit bias. So I'm going to throw off the definition of implicit bias, also known as implicit social cognition, I thought. Implicit bias refers to the attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding, actions, and decisions in an unconscious manner. Until we get real and get honest with how we really see the world around us and how we really see the people around us and stop feeling guilty and stop feeling the need to defend it and stop feeling the need to somehow defend the structures in place that gave it to us, how about start dismantling it? How about start challenging it? How about clicking and saying, here's my reflection on that horrible video. Once again, it was a middle schooler and a high schooler. Middle schooler was a black kid. High schooler was a white kid. You have an age disparity there as well. Was there any prelim investigation at all? Did you receive anything before you came up? In my mind, what I saw was you saw who she felt that she could control, mm-hmm. limitedly, and she did. And you saw who the other officer felt like he couldn't control, and you saw how he responded. It's based in my world, it's just who you perceive you have control over. That's really all it is, and who's more powerful than you. And you saw it's a certain level of this degree of force that was necessary. She clearly felt like the white kid didn't deserve the degree of force, although we know in the incident, he clearly was the aggressor. Implicit biases. Until we start getting to the root of who we are and how we got this way, we're going to keep having these issues, and everybody wants to keep hollering about how they're not racist. And tell me one more time the three black people you've had to your house. Okay.
Wow.
The thing is, the implicit biases thing, of course, is we're having that. I've been hearing about implicit bias probably for like 6 years or so now, but that's just because I've been focusing on policing, and that's what I do for journalism and stuff. If you bring up the concept of implicit bias outside of these circles, nobody's having a conversation about it. Nobody knows what it is. And if you try and give them that little introductory definition, they immediately disagree with it. And then when you talk about policing, it's a hodgepodge of whether or not there's any departments that are teaching it, whether or not they're teaching it consistently, whether or not they're making it a requirement. Most of the time, it's a checklist. Oh, yeah, we're doing implicit bias training. We did an 8-hour course. We'll see you again in a year. That doesn't do any good.
Exactly.
No, here's the thing. It's not even just about how you were raised. If you get into an organization where you have these predominant attitudes, where the powers that be have these biases, they will bleed over into your practice. You will be following the same attitude as your leadership. This is why I stand on my soapbox all the time about leadership and accountability for leadership, because we have this to authority in this country. And if the authority says that this is how we do business and you write my paycheck, then I follow what you do. And these biases are at the center of decision-making and in leadership as well. So it's not even just about what your mama and your papa and your papa taught you. It's alive and well in our organizational leadership. It's not just for the worker bee. The people who are making the policies and the decision-making that are the most concerning for me, because they're leading the drove. That was scary.
And, Chief, that had to be one of those videos where you come away from it and you go, oh, thank God that's not here. You know, that is a nightmare.
Yeah, well, I mean, I thought I was on mute when I said what I said. I hadn't seen that video. I hadn't viewed that thing yet. But it's wrought with problems. I mean, I'm going to find it and go back and look at it, but I can't clearly see any real actual resistance from the African-American male and its progress. Now, I mean, I'm going to tell you from law enforcement's perspective, you know, an issue where people are fighting, you know, physical force is always better than an intermediate weapon in that type of situation. But, you know, it's obvious how that played out in the perspective that it pushes. I mean, there's just no way to discern or to say that, no, that's not what happened. It is what happened. They went after one kid, sat him on a couch, and the other one was actually grabbed much more aggressively. I would have been better off if they both were grabbed aggressively and handcuffed, and, you know, that would be okay because we're breaking up the fight. But, you know, that grab there for the young African-American, the 14-year-old kid, I'm not necessarily seeing a bunch of resistance. You know, people also got to understand human performance and dynamics when we start talking about these physical encounters, particularly in law enforcement. I mean, think about it's a hard conversation to have with some of our new recruits because, you know, saying this, we've talked in the past, a lot of these kids have never been in a physical altercation ever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So for those of us that have been and trying to teach and train these new cadets that about physical altercations, think about the fight that you were involved in, you know, back before you became an officer. And if somebody did intervene and grab them, and this goes back to, you know, some of Dr. Cruz's research, your brain is not where it needs to be. It isn't focused. If somebody comes up and grabs me around the head, I don't know whether they're wearing a uniform or, you know, who it is, another person aggressing me. So you have to take that in consideration to let some of that brain reset when you grab a hold of somebody, a kid. That goes along with loud, repetitive verbal commands. We teach that on and on and on because the brain is not focused on what you're saying. They're focused on the altercation in itself. So you got to get, I didn't mean a punch, but you got to get that attention, right? So police, right? Repetitive, get them to focus in on you. Most likely, if that had occurred and if that did happen, which I didn't hear it in the video, that young man probably would have done exactly what the first kid did, and we wouldn't have been at this point. So, you know, that from an operator standpoint, that's just kind of want to throw in the implicit bias stuff. And you know, Izzy talked about, I've heard that stuff. I've heard implicit biases for 10 years. I mean, had a pretty good presentation, you know, at the White House when President Obama was in there in the 21st century policing models. And I can't remember the doctor's name that was there, but he did an outstanding program on implicit bias. And, you know, I mean, he was up front. We all got it. Every single one of us has an implicit bias somewhere, somehow. So getting through that training and understanding that research, just as Izzy said, when you say that in a law enforcement organization, it's like, oh, no, I don't. No, I sure don't. I've heard it time and time again. I have it. Everybody on this panel's got it. There's just no way. There's no way around it. It's now getting to recognize what your implicit bias is, and then how to deal in the context of your work environment around that implicit bias. It's again, it's something that has to be understood. It has to be defined. You have to recognize it and know that you got it, and then you can get over it.
Let me interject though. I got one problem with that. By my training, and I think most of our training, you don't leave two combatants uncuffed. How do you know
that? No.
From the back. So they both
I 100% agree with you. If you're going to put hands on somebody in that instance, they're going to be lawfully detained and handcuffed. Joe, there is no grabbing somebody and sitting them down. Right. Even if the kid had done this and said, hey, look, I give up. I know who you are. You're still going to get cuffed until we solve the issue.
I can always say, hey, I'm sorry, I released you. But
I can always.
From training purposes, they're both
right.
Going to be cuffed because, again, you don't know if the second attack has come.
But,
in fact,
yeah, no.
Most of our guys get killed on domestic. Oh, I'm not going to cuff that person because they're so fatigued. And wind up stabbing the shit out of somebody.
Right. But you can, and as we say in business, I can always unarrest you.
But if
it's a paper, it's a piece of paper, it's a report. Mm-hmm. I put cuffs on them, detained this individual, found out that they were, you know, witness, victims, whatever, and so we let them go because we couldn't determine at the time when we walked up. So in that instance, and just for the lay person that may be watching, when you go running in there, who's the victim, because I think, Joe, you said it turns out that the young 14-year-old man was the victim.
Right.
We don't know that. We don't know that from the beginning
right.
lens. But when we get there and we conduct the investigation like we should have, we would determine that he was the victim. And if he were handcuffed, he would be released.
Right,
but there would be documentation, or should be documentation, that we did that.
I mean, it comes down to this.
There it is.
Go ahead.
No. I'm just going to say at the end of the video, the Zakai, the young 14-year-old kid, he made more sense than any of the cops did. He said if they can't take the time to figure out what's going on, then maybe they shouldn't be here. And you know, and what's really, really sad about it is 5, maybe 10, maybe 20 years from now, depending on how that young man develops, somebody may say, how do you feel about the police? And he'll say, if he says, I hate the police, you're bad, you're anti-police. They're not going to go back and automatically know what his experience was with them. And I know officers will say, well, that's not fair to treat us all that way, which is 100%. I agree. Then all of us should be outraged at what those two officers did, because that impacts all of us. So the police nationwide, you don't get to view these videos and have something to say in the barbershop or in the locker room or in roll call. But yet if somebody, and I'm not expecting them to have a job and come on social media and do it, but if a citizen comes and asks you what you think about it, if you give the typical words, I have nothing to do with it, no comment, to that citizen, you're condoning it. So you don't get to give the, it's a few bad apples. That doesn't get to come out. Because when you cover for the bad apples, why do you think this problem, you said it, is why does it keep getting, you know why? Because we give excuses for it. Well, it's just a few bad apples. No, the whole apple cart is rotten. Not the orchard, the apple cart is rotten. And we need to start calling it out. When you get these officers who do these things and other officers knew how they were and didn't say anything, we have no problem charging people with conspiracy all the time. We do it all the time.
Hey, Stan, may I jump in for a second?
Sure.
The thing that I'm concerned about is whether or not someone called in and said, because if I recall correctly, now I'm not saying that they both groups shouldn't have been handcuffed. What I'm getting at is maybe who called in, say, two black guys are jumping my boyfriend or someone's trying to hurt my boyfriend, and they describe the black guy as being the aggressor. So without knowing what the nature of the call was, and as you guys as officers, you can explain to me if you got a phone call saying that two black guys was attacking a white guy, because remember you started off saying that he was standing up for another kid. So someone might have called in and said, well, my boyfriend is being attacked by two black guys. And immediately the cops come there and they grab the black guy. Not saying that the other guy shouldn't have been in cuffs. If you guys would have got that call, please explain to me how would you have dealt with that call.
John, I'll just say this and I'll back out. Chances are, when we get a call, remember, you're not talking to the officer in the car. You're talking to a dispatcher. And all we know is how that dispatcher translates the information and puts it in the call. Some are exact word for word. Some interpret. And very few calls are ever what they say they are when you get there. Information is left out. And remember, the person calling a lot of times is giving it from their perspective versus if a neighbor across the street is calling that has nothing to do with either party, they may give you more exact fact. When it's two parties, you're getting one person's side of it. So that's why it's important to come in and act unknown. You don't know who's who. Identify people and go from there. Chief?
Yeah, I was going to say, and this is for that particular call, and then I got another point to make, but the average law enforcement response across the United States is 3 minutes. Nobody called that call in. They saw that. They were there. So to me, there is no, it's two black males fighting and this. They saw exactly whatever that cell phone video showed you, because they were there way too quick. The other part, to kind of go back what Stan is talking about, Yeah, I mean, you ever play that game, you know, as a kid, you know, you get the line of people, and I say one thing to the next person, it gets transposed all the way down on the other end. By the time it gets to the other end, none of it is correct. And then there's issues with eyewitness statements, which I know Izzy's probably got info on that, but what you see, through the lens of your eyes is completely, or could be completely different than what I see in the lens of my eyes. So when I talk about one of the classes I teach, which is a civilian response active shooter, I try to explain to citizens the best way that I can give this to you is when it all goes down and everybody starts calling 911, by the time we arrive on scene, we're going to be looking for a tall, short dude with yellow and green hair, and it'll be all over the place. So what Stan said is correct. You have to go in with what information you've got, but when you show up, you have to let the situation dictate what is happening. You know, I say this often, you know, and we get these BS suspicious person calls on the street, right? And it's somebody walking down the roadway. When the squad car pulls up, if they turn around and they just kind of look at you, they're probably not doing anything bad, because if they were, in my experience, if they were doing something bad, as soon as they see the headlights on the squad car, they are gone. So, you know, it becomes problematic with this report, right? And I'm not even going to go into how many videos are out there with Karen. He's assaulting me. He's assaulting me. And there's a video, the guy's like, ma'am, I'm videotaping you. I'm not assaulting you. So we get that person calling dispatch, who's then providing us that information, which becomes problematic. So officers need to, in some instances, and not in a high-stress, you know, shooting call, active shooter, those type of calls, but they need to take it in, right? As they show up, they need to stop. There's no reason to go flying into a situation to try to determine, you know, what's going on. So with that, Joe, do you got anything to add for that particular situation?
Sound good.
I think you're correct on all those. I think the it's interesting because I just got off the phone earlier this evening speaking with another friend of mine who's developing a program teaching emotional intelligence. And guess who the target audience is?
Law enforcement.
and I tried to get her on tonight, but I told her, of course, she was going to be there, so she backed out. So I guess, you know, that's what it is when you're a gangster.
To me, that is one of the most important aspects of this business. That's a lot. It's not taught. It's not talked about enough. And emotional intelligence for law enforcement, I've said it time and time again, I think it is one of the keys to this business. And I go back to, why is it that we have some law enforcement officers that span decades, right, that were able to do this job? They weren't on this video. They didn't act aggressively towards another group of people. And they were able to maintain and navigate all this nonsense that we have to deal with on a day-in, day-out basis. And they were seen as good.
Here's the other thing we tend to gloss over. The issue of cognitive dissonance plays into this, because that also goes hand in hand with the disconnect. You know, the fact is that they don't see these people as humans. And I've heard radio traffic, you know, the male usual. I think I told you all that story.
Yeah.
The male usual, or they're savages, and you know, so the fact that you've got people that make those type of statements and they're wearing guns.
What's worse is, before we get to the people making the statements, let's talk about the people training those people who eventually will make the statements. You know, you got the war stories.
Or supervising them.
Yes. The war stories are always...
As soon as you said that, Joe, I'm thinking, bye.
Yeah, I mean, if we're policing from a state of fear, and that's what it is. I was afraid for my safety. I was afraid for my life, for the most mundane reactions to people. If you're that afraid, go do something else. Because people should not have to die because you're afraid. They shouldn't have to go to the hospital and get facial reconstruction because you're afraid. And I don't know whether it's a fear of race, whether it's a fear of the unknown, but too much of policing is based upon fear and not overcoming the unknown in the environment. We walk into unknowns all the time. And you deconstruct them, this isn't a threat, this makes me uncomfortable, this I'm afraid of. But you can't just go in all the time and be in fear and then do these crazy things to get the daylight suit out of cities and then get to go, well, we just need more training. We have to stop policing in fear.
Comment goes directly into my pop-off for today. So this is where my pop-off was coming from. My whole life, I have heard about police being in fear for their life as a justification for innocent people to die. And my whole life, I have watched the suspect in whatever case that was being pursued that caused and created the situation where an innocent person got killed get prosecuted for murder as a result of their actions creating and causing this whole chain of events. My whole life, this is what I've watched. And I've watched police officers be able to say, I was afraid for my life. And I've watched prosecutors defer prosecution and defer any further anything. And then I hear about the man in Houston who he and his wife were robbed outside of the Chase Bank, and he was legally carrying, shot at the robber, wrongly shot in a vehicle of the wrong person, and shot and killed a 9-year-old little girl. Now, I hear the story. I didn't see the story. I heard it, and I thought, that's on the robber. The robber created the situation, right? I see you, Chief. The robber created the situation. So I'm listening, and I'm hearing everybody's responses about being responsible for the projectile that you fired from your gun, and I'm hearing all of this. And then I started thinking, I wonder what the person who shot and killed the little girl looked like. So because I got hit with a barrage of things and I was offering a different perspective, I go and look, and much to my surprise, or not, he doesn't look like me. And this is where my pop-off comes. I'm not saying the man was right. I'm not saying that he doesn't have responsibility. When you choose to load a gun and carry it on your person for whatever your reasoning is, you are responsible for the outcome that comes from it. Where my pop-off comes from, how is it that we have allowed people who have had training, who have had all of these things, to be able to use an excuse of, I was afraid for my life? I've explained to y'all about how the brain works. I can vibe with that. I'll tell you all day long how it doesn't work well after a stressful situation, especially a traumatic one. It shuts down. We talk about this, fight, flight, freeze. I'm with you. But this man is sitting in jail on a $100,000 bond. The judge refused to reduce his bond, and it was because of this situation that was completely outside of his control, except for the fact that he made a poor decision with a firearm. And, oh, yeah, by the way, in the state of Texas, everybody's got one these days, and you don't really even have to have any training to have one at mm-hmm. home, at least.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece of this accountability is, when we started wanting police accountability and we were tired of privilege and we were tired and we want police accountability and we want police accountability, I am sick to death that the only police officers that are being held accountable are the ones that are black and brown. I am sick to death of the sacrificial lambs that keep thrown out to slaughter every time, and yet the original issue that we've been complaining about and articulating for all of these years is still here, and yet we're still not addressing it, and there's hope. Yeah, implicit bias.
Joe, I can, she gets the Martin Lawrence Award. You kept it. You press your points. Woosah.
I'm on my woosah. No, I'm so sick of it. Just kidding. Do people listen to themselves when they talk?
Yeah, but see, there's two. You bring up two issues, and the first one is going to probably be argued within the Supreme Court in the next, I'd say, next year, and that's this thing called the felony murder rule, especially what that's basically what we're talking about. And again, how that applies, it is not applied equally. We know that, especially in that case. We had a couple of cases here where the homeowner shot at a kid who was still in his car. He shot at and killed one. One of the kids got charged, and it didn't go well, let's just say that. But your point is, I agree. But again, the felony murder rule is going to be challenged at some point, probably in this next session, because of that. Do I agree with it? I think that he's again, if it was fair, I mean, I got to use this thing. If this thing was fair, then yeah, and if it was applied and equally across the board, then probably would be a good thing. But it is not. And we all, I agree. Who's the
Oh, I have one thing about the implicit bias, and I'll go back to Chief before I forget. So here's a reflection question, if you have any implicit biases. Do you ever use the term they? Do you ever discuss a group of people or a subsection of people? It does not have to be all of a group of people. It is a subsection, a subgroup of a group. When you refer to them, do you refer to them as they? They. So if you find yourself using terms like they, just talk about groups of people, even subgroups of people, there's likely some implicit biases, and you need to go back to the root of that and see exactly where those ideas and those attitudes come from.
It'd be a whole, it's going to be a whole lot of training curriculums rewritten after that statement.
I just think I used that today because I said, hey, they need to go over there and do that training. So, yeah, I guess then I used that in the context. Well, I used that in that context. I think, oh, my God, Phil. Anyway, one of the things I did want to bring up, one of the things I wanted to bring up was that, and I get what you're saying about if I was in fear of my life, but I don't want to leave it at that because there's how, why, right? There's some very clear cases where individuals are in fear of their lives, in fear for their lives. There are cases where officers are not or shouldn't have been, i.e., you know, they don't have a weapon. You know, if somebody says, hey, the guy pulled a gun on me, I was in fear of my life, you know, and it's on video or whatever, that is pretty clear. So some of this deals with, well, I would say it deals with the police administrations, and then it also deals with the district attorney's office. So When we talk about that, I don't want the public just to think that I can walk in and say, yeah, this happened because I was in fear of my life, and everybody goes, okay, cool. I'm sure there's probably plenty of places that are like, okay, that's good. In my experience with people that I work with, that doesn't fly. There's got to be more to that. Like, and I was going to say something about reported uses of force, in particular to that video. Because it came up a little bit earlier, but it was, you know, why did you do that? Well, they were resisting. How? It goes back to that articulation of those officers to the point where we are at the point for I can only talk about my agency, some of the agencies that are around me because we had these conversations, but, you know, defining what they did, defensive resistance. Well, how did they display defensive resistance? Well, they tried to pull their arm away from it. Right, difference between defensive resistance and active aggression. So those definitions become key when we talk about that articulation point. But I'm not saying that it's missed upon my idea that some agencies can say I'm in fear of my life and everybody goes, okay, cool, we're done. It's obviously that happens. The one thing I do want to say, and I really don't care what anybody thinks about that, but if you use deadly force against somebody. And you guys are Joe, Dan, y'all can correct me if I'm wrong, but many, many years ago, I was told pretty much very early on in the department, if I fired my weapon for whatever reason, justified or not justified, and my round struck somebody or killed somebody, I owned that. And it's plain and simple. My personal opinion, that's on the individual that did it. So, because if I'm, again, knowing your targets, et cetera, stuff like that, I know it doesn't happen. What was her name? Kim Potter, is that the one that mistook her taser for the handgun?
Mm-hmm.
I know there was a lot of conversation about that. I'm perfectly fine in charging that individual. I fully believe today if I go out and I screw up in that, if it were me and I screw up in that instance, I expect to be charged. My personal belief is I expect to be charged because that's the responsibility that's been put on me, and I think we've lost that somewhere along the ways within law enforcement. That's any instance like that, you have to be held accountable for it.
But
talk about this accountability, and we talk about these low levels of the departments. That's a major issue that you should be held accountable for. How it happened, what brought it on, all that stuff is part of the trial and should be put in there. Just my two cents.
But wouldn't it be fair, and I agree with what you said, but I think in police training, We spend a lot of money and time on training how to physically control people. And it's not like being physically fit. It's at the top of our agenda as a profession to do if you've seen some of the officers that are out there after 5 years on the job. Then we spend a whole ton of money shooting rounds downrange when we need to be proficient. But we're willing to spend money to train to put the deadly force option out there, which we should have, and you should be proficient. But we don't spend enough money on the mental education. We actually, and let's just be 100% honest, we are taught, it is drilled in our heads, these commands. I was in fear of my life. Stop resisting. Get on the ground. Let me see your hands. And we train that so much that the officers don't have the ability, or it's not, they're not given the option to react to their environment. They're doing what they're mechanically trained to do. And that is evident when we see all these videos where four officers are on top of some guy on the ground and they're still yelling, get on the ground.
Right.
Or they're saying, show me your hands, and their hands are up because they're cycling through that mental checklist. They're not seeing the environment. And if you're telling the guy to get on the ground and there's three people on top of him, including you, you're not in control.
Yeah, I may make some officers mad here, but you're 100% correct. We do not train enough, and I saw Dr. Cruz point to her mouth. Or the 6 inches between your ears. We do not train enough with that. There's courses that we go to, and it's limited training. And by comparison, it doesn't match those other things. And I agree with you, Stan. We have to be proficient in hands-on, intermediate weapons, defensive counter-strikes, defensive tactics, handguns, because in many places, those things are used quite often, right? I mean, on a daily basis. But I have a personal belief that executive-level training should – filtered down to the newest people within the organization. Stuff that I go to, as far as leadership is concerned, should be pushed down and drilled down to this person.
But,
when you get a culture like that of that core leadership values and stuff within an agency, I think in that training with using your brain and using your mouth, I think you're gonna have a possibility to eliminate some of this product and go back to what Izzy likes to say, hire the right people.
But, Chief, I think that training costs absolutely zero. It doesn't have to be mandated from the chief. That training starts when you get your ass out of that patrol car and go meet these people who make you uncomfortable or you're afraid of. You'll develop relationships. Then that makes you a better officer. I don't believe that you can sit in a classroom for 8 or 40 hours. And if you're uncomfortable with black people or white people or tan people, short, we can't train that out of you. You've got to be willing to overcome it. And I think we spend too much money looking for these pretty courses that give us T-close hours so we don't have to, you know, spend money over here on something else when that officer is not going to get his ass out of the car and apply the training you paid all that money for him to take in a formal classroom. If you want to survive in those streets, you want to stay away from being sued, you want to stay away from being one of these videos, get your ass out the car and meet people.
Well, yeah, you're right. But I'm going to use this as an example because I got the opportunity to be a commander of a multi-jurisdictional SWAT team, built the thing ground up. It was a model. I talked about it. It was based on the Northern Illinois alarm system up there by around Joe. We had the ability to train people, bring folks in that never done this stuff before. And the reason that we did this is, the idea was if your life was in danger, who would you want to come get you? I think that should be the same thing throughout law enforcement. What kind of person do you want working for your police agency? Do you want the $12 an hour guy or do you want the $35 an hour guy? There's a difference between the two. I use that dollar figures, but train them. And it is that, and it's exactly that, getting out into these neighborhoods, being around people that you don't know, but some areas don't have the opportunity to do that, but what I'm talking about is that higher level leadership, command college stuff. I mean, you know, they sent me to it. I learned quite a bit from it, but I grew from that as well because I was with peers that, you know, were in agents of LAPD. I had people from LAPD in there. The problems of LAPD in Southern Dallas County were not the same. So, I mean, it was an interesting perspective to learn from those peers there, but we need to train our folks up to a completely different level. Quit doing the range every couple of weeks, that let's start talking, let's start using more of this and more of this.
Absolutely.
And I think again, coupled with emotional intelligence, and I'm going to say it again, going back and hiring the right people to begin with, that makes a significant amount of difference. Make it hard for people to get on the job. If not, because you got a heartbeat and you can be certified by your state that we should make you an office in our agency, make it the difficult selection process. So, you know, you're getting the right people at the right time in there. And then, of course, that also goes with continual on to the career. You know, we've talked about that.
And build the database of bad officers who are fired from departments so they can't go down the road and get hired somewhere else. That way, personnel departments can go straight to that list first. If this person's on that list, they're automatically a no-go. That's something that should be done.
But police departments are not
good at reporting anything because they have a lot of them don't even report their UCR stats to the FBI, and we rely on UCR statistics that aren't correct.
Yeah, and I don't know what other states are doing on the backgrounds, but that's key. I can tell you what Texas has done. They just passed as crazy as we got stuff going on here, but they did pass a bill. And Stan, you'd understand this under a civil service 143 agency, there's an A file and a G file.
Mm-hmm.
G file was only viewed by the chief. The bill eliminated that. That's open to background anytime. I don't necessarily know that, well, they're not yet. There's not a tracking of places where they have applied, but there is a tracking of where they have worked.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, as of a couple months ago, if we don't provide the information or human resource didn't provide the information, I, as the chief executive officer, my license is going to be suspended. And then there's a civil penalty for the city. I think it's $1,000 a day until they comply with said order. The backgrounds have always been a problem. I mean, go talk to TECL, the Commission on Law Enforcement Education. Go ask them. Go ask the executive director. I had a conversation with them last week. It has been an issue to get the correct information. But you go, so I, as an example, the city of Plano, which is a very large agency in North Texas, their chief had drained. He had a conversation. They're hiring people from New York. They're hiring people from Chicago. And guess what they can't get? Their backgrounds. Because of collective bargaining and or union agreements, they say, hey, we'll come up and view the background of that officer. And they say, nah, you can't look at it. There's no reciprocity between states, so we're running into some of those issues. It's easy for me to go next door to somebody coming from a smaller agency down the road. I can take my rear end right over there and go look at everything because by law they have to show it to me. And if they don't, then I report them to the licensing agency. It's a start. It's not perfect, but dang it, it's a start.
Amen. Well, we're at about that 10-minute mark. Everybody woo-side out? Got it all out the system? I know you got plenty.
I always got plenty. I always agree with the chief on everything. It's in coupling with this, we need to keep, like I said, the conversation needs to go further. So, I mean, I've covered conferences recently where experts have said that you can, like, a lot of this high crime that we're dealing with right now, you can find it, and it's localized in certain communities, in certain areas, being done by certain people. One of the craziest statistics that I heard about was he pointed out that a large amount, like in terms of Boston, they managed to localize the majority of criminality to one area of Boston of a community of, I think it was like 1,500 to 2,000 people. So you can localize. And we're having this conversation. And we're doing it here in New York as well. Same thing. Like they say, this is happening in small groups of people, small communities. We localize it. But then we respond with policing. And I'm like, we know what the problems are. Why don't we look there and see what other problems are existing in those communities that might be contributing to this problem? There are studies that show, because if you go into these neighborhoods and stuff, there's other things that need to be fixed to help improve so you can stop this stuff from continuing to happen. Because we've been doing policing, and it's not working. So we got to start trying other things. I mean, there are studies that have shown that when they've gone in to communities and repaired housing and repaired public areas,
mm-hmm.
crime has dropped
mm-hmm.
by like 15 and 20%. It's dropped. So why – I want to see a shift in like the initiatives because we put so much initiative and so much emphasis and attention to improving policing, retraining policing, reforming policing, putting money in policing, doing all this stuff. What if we took like 20% of that energy and we're like, let's build some fucking houses.
Yeah.
Let's repair some parks. The NYPD has the $10 billion budget. Like, I'm not saying take all of that, but if you took $2 billion a year and put it into repairing the housing and the schools and some of the communities where this violence is happening, could we see what would happen? Could we give it a shot? If it doesn't work, we'll go back to what you guys are doing, and, you know, we'll say we were wrong. But I bet it might work, and it might help. So, like, in the conversation of policing, like, this, it's as complex as it can get, but, like, we keep just focusing on both repairing it and changing it to solve these other problems that, at the root of it, it doesn't really have anything to do with.
Final thoughts? Let me go to our caller real quick. You're still on. Ty, you got any final thoughts? 1 minute.
Yeah, well, that word explicit bias, it rings a bell all the time because explicit bias starts in the educational system and the misrepresentation of what they consider black people as minorities in that. And so many people are the way they are by default. It starts with the educational system, which, of course, is part of retraining people to think differently. But I can't blame people for feeling and thinking a certain way if they've already been systemically programmed and I didn't say educated, programmed to think that way. So my final pop-off is the explicit bias in the educational programming that is way short of what it should be due so that we can have some real justice and have people look at each other differently with a more panoramic view, so to speak. And that's it, Stan.
All right, Big John.
Yeah, John, I agree with pretty much everything that's been said, and I yield my time.
You got a new addition to your family up there, didn't you?
Yes. Maya is my first South African warble. And the bite of the warble has been compared to a shark bite. You can go research it. This dog's bite's been compared to, and I've been training her with dolls of Joe Mosley. And let me say, she's getting better already. I'm very impressed.
Fire.
Calls up of Joe.
Fire. My dog carries guns, baby.
Hey, Stan.
We don't bite. We like.
Hey, Stan, I do want to say this, Stan, that when I was going down to Maryland, and I think maybe you and Joe both commented safe travels, as I was traveling, I had a gym bag, but a backpack, and I had my wallet in there with all my information. And as we were driving, we hit Delaware, actually Jersey, you gotta say.
Yeah.
They was pulling people over like left and right.
Mm-hmm.
And I told my cousin, I said, "Yo, man, pull over." So he was like, "Well, what's up, man? You gotta use the bathroom, man. We find a better place, man, for you to do what you gotta do.
Get that wallet out."
I said, "Nah." I said, "I want to grab my wallet out of the back because I started thinking, like, if we get pulled over and they ask me for my ID, then, I try to explain to an officer, I'm reaching for my IDs in the back. I wasn't going to go through that."
Mm-hmm.
So he pulled over. He said, "Oh, man, you could have waited for that." I said, "Nah, bro. I'm not going to be put in that situation where I'm reaching. Don't reach for that gun. That's all you're going to hear." And to what you guys were saying, the problem I have is cops have a lot of language that they use. In court, I don't recall. When they don't want to just outright lie, they say, "I don't recall."
Well, that's an outright lie. That's an outright lie.
And they're
because it should be on the paper in front of them.
And well, we know they'll do that on paper. I can prove it.
So, you know, there's language that they have that they use, and I don't know, is this a method that's taught to them? Like, yo, man, if you're in this situation, and if the prosecutor asks you this or the lawyer asks you this, just say, I don't recall. If you shoot someone or you punch someone, you did this, man, I was in fear for my life. So,
John, I can honestly say to that, when I got trained on court procedures, I was actually told, you know, if you don't know something, and this is what gets a lot of officers in trouble in court, we feel like we have to answer or have an answer for everything. If you don't know,
nope,
just simply say you don't know, because they know half the time that you don't know. They're asking you to see if you're going to try to talk anyway. They know you don't know. You can't know. Just say, I don't know.
Hey, Stan, but you know the problem is? You could testify all the way up to the point where it may help me as a defendant, or if this is still a matter of me as the appellant, or whatever the case may be, right? But at that moment, that where it becomes beneficial, like, oh, this testimony might help him if I testify, I don't recall. Mm-hmm. But you recalled every other little step. Courts allow cops to get away with that bull crap.
Whoa. Let me stop. I can say, did that happen? Yes. I can tell you now, the courts, definitely. If you look in the last, I think within the last 5 years, the courts are not taking the policemen as expert testimony anymore. In fact, the one death knell to a case is to say, maybe. Or I think we talked about it before, when they ask you, did you read my client his Miranda warnings? And then they go, the next step is, how did you read it to him? Oh, obviously you read it from your memory, huh? Oh, well, let's see. What'd you have for lunch last week? And you can't remember that. Well, that's an old trick, but it works. Because some of these egotists will say, oh, I remember. So give me those Miranda warnings. How many are there? Most people take you 10. It's not 10. It's not 10.
You have the right to remain silent, right to have cable TV. You have
my point being that the courts are definitely not taking policeman testimony anymore. That's the gospel. Most defense attorneys will eat you alive for saying some of what those exact same things you're saying. On the appellate side, even worse. But because the judicial system is getting more scrutiny, a lot more reversals on the appellate side, because they are finding out a lot of cops online. No question. Particularly when we look at certain types of crime. Narcotics courts, they should have been investigating half those guys a long time ago. And I can tell you that as a homicide guy.
Yeah, I'll back up and say that, you know, not so much homicide, you know, when we talk about these major case crimes, but, you know, on-site arrests or on-duty arrests, if it's not on video, most of the courts, that in my experience, if it's not on video or audio, it didn't happen.
At this point,
so I can't just walk in. I can't walk in and say this happened, and they go, "Hey, all right, Chief, good deal, man. We'll go ahead." If I can't produce it,
and Chief, can
I don't necessarily say, think that's wrong.
The idea that nobody's playing you is out the window. They can forget that. Oh, Your Honor, I saw that pile of dope on the back.
But hey, Joe, but if I can suggest. And, John, I'm going to grab you in a minute. If I could suggest this to anybody listening, go down to your department. It's 2022. We were dictating reports at Waco PD in 1993 and having them typed out. And the next day you read through your report and correct grammatical errors, or, hey, I forgot to put this in or that, and then you send it back through. If your department in 2022 still has officers pen and ink writing offense reports, not only is it cutting down on their time on the street, they're going to be tired after a long shift, they're going to make a lot of mistakes, and then you need to tell your department to get with it. Because if we were dictating reports in Waco, Texas in 1993, there's no reason any police department in this country in 2022 still be doing handwritten criminal offense reports. There's no reason for it.
Go ahead, John. As long as they wear badges, the courts will give them a lot more leeway than they would do regular civilians. I don't care who say, who wants to argue that fact. The courts give them more leeway. And not only that, I would say the civilians, people that comes in as juries, will tell you straight up, oh, he's a police officer, of course. I believe his testimony. But you haven't heard no evidence. You haven't heard no evidence. Because of that badge, people put cops at a standard, regardless of what they read in the news, they hold them to a standard here because they took an oath, like the judge took an oath, like the prosecutor took an oath, like the lawyer took an oath. But at the end of the day, it's bullshit.
Well, how many videos have we seen?
A lot of people are filling the prisons up because of this bullshit.
I'll say, at least in my experience, it may not be fast, but it certainly has eroded.
And John,
my experience with court, it's not, it didn't happen overnight. And who did it? I'm telling you, Joe would tell you. I can almost guarantee you, when Joe got on stand early in his career, if he said it was Christmas, everyone was going to start wrapping their packages because that was the gospel. As he got more into his career higher up, the amount of evidence that he had to have to provide to prove has gone way beyond where that used to be. Now, do I say has it happened fast enough? Probably not. But my experience in my local jurisdiction, in the places that I've worked, I'm telling you, I could do that too. I could walk in there and say, this happened. They'd be like, hell yeah, done. Nowadays, I got to go in court. I better have a lot of supporting evidence and video and audio and blah, blah, blah.
Let's not give policing the credit on that or the court the credit on that. That came about because social media and videoing.
I don't want you to.
We
did that to ourselves.
By doing
what we shouldn't have been doing, have created that issue. I'm not saying we did it out of greatness of our heart.
Yeah.
We changed it. The bad officers changed it to put us to where that is today.
But it didn't start coming until a lot of people of color who have complained about how they were treated by the police, not over the years, over generations, were told, oh, that can't be happening. Oh, that didn't happen. Oh, this officer would never do that. Then they started, somebody came up and put cameras in phones.
In cars.
And we saw it with
It started before that. It started back with the cameras in the cars.
Right.
That's where it began.
Even before that, it started with Rodney King. Had there not been a video, there never would have been a prosecution. And it's gone from there. So now we see even today, there are cases that are only convictions, and these guys only go to court because somebody pulled out a phone and that video went viral.
Okay, I agree with all that, but let me just give one piece of credit. I give the credit to the people who have the balls enough to be jurors, to have the balls enough to be a registered voter, to sit on those juries. You know, it's one thing to have a camera video, that's all well and good. But until you sit your ass on that jury, until you take that time to listen to that story. See, if you're not there, it ain't going to happen. See, if you're not there, then somebody's going to waste 24 years of their life to get to an appellate court, to get to the judge that doesn't believe that lying ass police. So, no, a lot of that goes to the system.
I'm going to close.
Juries don't have a great track record.
But they got a better one they had. Police don't have a good track record either. Right?
Oh, I know, but I mean, it's like the juries are. I agree with you about serving on juries and stuff like that. But I mean, you're kind of just acknowledging it's going to go to trial. Most of the reason a lot of these guys wind up in prison is because they plea out. Because everybody says if this goes to trial, you're going to serve even more fucking time.
Yeah.
And juries today, you're ignoring the jury selection process. So they are picking people that don't give a damn about that other person's story and are just like done.
But if you're not there, then you can't be the one that ain't selected.
Well, Jesse Washington had a jury.
I'm just saying that
Jesse Washington had a jury and so did Emmett Till.
My final point was, Joe, was this. There's people who are innocent, right? And I'm not saying that these people in jail are innocent, but there's people who
are innocent.
And, okay,
A lot of them are.
But these people that are sitting right now in the county jail, contemplating taking a plea agreement, that are innocent, because his lawyer told him, well, it's your testimony against this officer.
Dude, I'll do you one better. A third of those guys are innocent of crimes that never happened.
Well, I don't know about that. And the real jury has spoken.
Huh. No, it's true. A third of the exonerations that happen are not just of innocence. It's no crime convictions. They're convicted of crimes that never actually happened. And they usually often will plea and take it.
You got to send me those stats.
I will absolutely send you the stats, buddy. Wait. I don't need to send you the stats. Do your own Googling. Just Google
Nope. You brought it up. You bring it, baby.
A third of exoneration.
You brought it, you bring it. Man,
I believe you. All right, Dr. Cruz, final thoughts.
Own it. Personal responsibility was my focus for today. Own it. Do your reflection. Go to your ugly dark spots that you're not real proud of and figure out how they got that way and shine some light there. Expecting grace for ourselves and being willing to bury others, we've got to deal with this hypocrisy at some point. So personal responsibility is my suggestion for that.
All right. And with that, we appreciate everybody. Lively. Boy, Izzy, I like you being in here. But I do want to see is you got to take a picture of that ceiling so I can see what's up there, because whatever it is interesting as hell. You'll be talking.
What do you mean? It's the ceiling light. It's reflecting off the.
Oh, okay. I was like, what? You had me looking at mine. I'm like, is it in here too?
No, it's a New York thing. We've got trash down by underneath the window. We've got gnats to get into the apartment.
Oh man.
So they fly in and around and stuff like that. It's nice.
We'll be off this Saturday, guys. You know. This Saturday, I'll be turning the big 6-0. So I'm going to get some old man rest and celebrate. So, you know.
You having a prune birthday cake? Or
no. No, I'm just going to get up in the morning and have that Metamucil. You know, Joe shipped me some of his extra.
Hey, you know. The police are going to be coming to your house. The knees are going to be popping. They're going to sound like gunshots going off. They're knocking on your door.
No, trust me, man. When you live around Atlanta, nobody reports gunshots. They wake you. Had to actually physically be in the street with the whole crime scene. They're not going to come in the house. Hey, it's just in the house, no problem. You know. But Atlanta is putting cameras everywhere. They brought a couple thousand everywhere.
Around the city.
Yeah. So now it's going to be like Atlanta FaceTime, you know, people taking selfies.
Camera ain't locked up nobody yet.
Crime cameras.
Big camera in Chicago got done. Too many. And they still ain't locked up nobody.
You got to turn them on.
They are.
Ours are working in New York, man. We're putting away a lot of people with the cameras.
I saw the ones in Chicago. They got iPhone 6s duct taped to telephone poles. Hey guys, I appreciate everybody. Yeah, we're gonna get
happy
out.
Happy early birthday!
Oh, thank you all.
Birthday,
all right, and we'll see you all I guess next week. Be good. Say no to thugs.
Other thugs.